All right, good evening. Tonight is the second in a series of talks. There's going to be a third one. So the first one was last week, and it was on the historical organization and basically the infrastructure of the historical Sangha. And we did a number of clarifications about at least the historical meaning of community and of Dana, and emphasized that the entire purpose of the structure and practice was to facilitate awakening both of the individuals in the community and then everyone supporting each other in the process of awakening. I mean, that's the end game of spiritual community. So tonight, I want to look at the teachings of the historical Buddha and what happened with them from immediately after his death up basically to the present, talk a little bit about what I think is happening in the Western community, and then there's going to be a third talk, which probably will be, I don't know, it's 3 or 4 months from now, I'm not sure what the date is, but what I'm going to do specifically is focus on Sacrament of Insight Meditation and where I think they are and where I think they're going and some things that we might do with the community. Immediately after the Buddha's death, within 3 months of the Buddha dying, there was what they call the First Council of Elders. So we're talking about Theravadan Buddhism, what Theravadan Buddhism means, how it has changed or not changed in terms of its relationship to the teachings, and then how it's manifesting today. And I'm going to be talking about the teachings themselves as opposed to, you know, maybe the cultural or organizational things that have happened with Theravadan Buddhism, because with all the different traditions, as things change, there are these, I think there's kind of waves of change organizationally and operationally. You know, there's some excesses, there's reactions to those excesses, they're pulled back in. But the thing that I'm really interested in with respect to Theravadan Buddhism is their relationship to the teachings themselves, which for me is the thing that I'm really interested in. So within 3 months after the Buddha's death, there was a convocation. It was led by one of the senior monks named Mahakasapa. They were the Kasapa brothers. And they had been responsible, these two brothers, for bringing a very large number of practitioners into the community. And there's a famous story in the suttas that happened at Rajgir, where we've been on pilgrimage, and where the Kasapa brothers, with their following of 500 followers, all of whom were part of this Indian Shramana tradition at the time, they were wandering, homeless practitioners, trying to find the ultimate answer to suffering and to peace. They all had didn't cut their hair. They had long matted hair, and the Kasapa brothers, in particular, part of their practice had to do with a belief in the power of fire and the symbolism of fire. So they called them fire eaters. So there's this scene of the Kasapa brothers and 500 of their followers coming into Rajgir, this little village, to meet with the Buddha and the Sangha. And Rajgir is the very first place where land had been donated by a benefactor to the Buddha and his community to establish some kind of a base for the Sangha. So they arrive at this beautiful bamboo grove, and then there's, you know, this scene of them questioning the Buddha, and to make a long story short, they say, this guy's the real thing, sign us up, and they stay. So over the next 45 years, Kasapa, when one of the two brothers, when they King, you know, they were young men. And so when the Buddha died, one of the two, which the term, you know, Maha, when you see that in front of a name, means the great. So it's the great Kassapa. So one of the two brothers became just the natural leader of the community, not the principal teacher, as the Buddha was. No one took that position. But Kassapa became the elder and the leader of the community. So he led this first council, and the criterion for attending this council, the purpose of the council, was to bring together the elders that had surrounded the historical Buddha, who were teaching with the Buddha, and gathering them together to agree upon what were the fundamental core of the Buddha's teaching, his psychology, and the recommended practices. That was the purpose of this first council. And the criterion for participating, the cost of the ticket to get into this event was that you needed to have been in the community for at least 10 years, and you had to be recognized by the entire community as being awakened being. So that was the base. And there were 500 monks who attended this council. You know, there's a number of stories about this, and Ananda, of course, who was the Buddha's attendant, and apparently had something close, if not an actual photographic memory, had really given up his life and his practice to be with the Buddha almost all the time. And his function, his role, was to be with the Buddha and to be able to recite back not just the suttas themselves, the discourses, the talks that the Buddha gave, but also like the questions and answers. So people would come in, meet with the Buddha, he would give them advice, and Ananda's role was to know all of that. So he played a key role in this, but because he had devoted his life to the Buddha and this role, he had not yet awakened. So they set the time for this out 3 months, and they basically said to Ananda, hey, you know, you better get your act together, because we need you at the council, and you're not coming if you don't wake up. You know. So there's all these stories, some of them quite humorous, about, you know, Ananda really kicking it into high gear, and then supposedly that, you know, the night before the council, it was like, you know, hey Ananda, hey, has it happened yet? You know, and so supposedly the night before the council began, he awakened, and then he participated. There were also, as we talked about last time, you know, whole series of very, very skilled senior teachers in the community, elders, who were responsible for various various suttas and the meanings of various suttas, and for particular principles, dependent origination, certain practices, equanimity, metta. And so all of them had become very, very skilled, you know, it was an oral tradition, right? So they knew these suttas inside out and backwards. And so it must have been quite a scene to bring 500 monks together with no microphones and brought, you know, not speaking systems, and figure out how to make this thing work. But in the end, there was a unanimity of the 500 monks on what the foundational teachings were, the foundational psychology, and the Vinaya, or the ethical rules of conduct. And to cement that there was undivided agreement, they took months to chant all of the suttas. And to kind of commemorate that, and for community members, monastic community members, to reaffirm their undivided commitment to a set of teachings, those practices still go on. So in Bodh Gaya, when we were there, there were hundreds of monks, and they were engaged in this multi-day process of, together from different traditions, chanting a number of the suttas. And later, the year before, there had been a 10-day sutta chanting event, which happens, I think, every other year, where in 10 days, you know, you couldn't chant all the suttas. But there's a whole set of suttas, and it's a reenactment of this monumental event that took place, where this established the foundation for everything that followed in terms of Buddhism. Okay. So, you know, it really was like kind of an extraordinary event, because it reaffirmed and it codified the core teachings, the core psychology, and the core practices. It was focused on a set of practices that have to do with bringing the mind and the body and the energies in the body and the mind into balance. A system that's based on wisdom, supported by kindness and compassion, focusing on liberating insights from suffering, and then using the historical Buddha and his 45 years of teaching and service as the Bodhisattva model. In Theravadan Buddhism, there is a single Bodhisattva, not multiple Bodhisattvas. And that Bodhisattva is the model of the historical Buddha, so that the ultimate gift of service from a Theravadan perspective is either offering the teachings, offering the Dharma, or embodying the Dharma in your relationship with other people, you know, in terms of helping. One thing that was significant about this convocation and the findings of the council that isn't stressed very much, because I think it's because we're in an era of being wanting to be obsessionally politically correct, is that the council selected and affirmed a whole series of suttas that the Buddha gave, which basically carefully distinguish his teachings from the teachings of other groups and sects that were operating at the time. And just in the suttas, 37 different other schools or teachers or sects are mentioned that the Buddha is distinguishing his teachings from them. And this is where, you know, we kind of talk about, you know, right speech, right livelihood, right wisdom, right? And we always go, well, what that really means is skillful. And actually, while that's true, the Buddha actually meant that it's the right path, and that there's actually a wrong eightfold path. And there's a sutta where he says, everything that you have, you know, livelihood, mindfulness, meditation, concentration, all eight steps of the three training can be done improperly and lead you astray. And when you do that, you are not on the path. And in fact, one of the recognized liberating insights is whether or not you can tell you're on the path or not. So for me, this is like a fascinating piece of this. There's one very lengthy sutta, and I mean it's a long one, and it's entitled What the Practice Is Not. So while, you know, we're very concerned about being politically correct, I don't think the Buddha was, but the Buddha didn't, it wasn't couched in those terms. He was distinguishing his teachings from other teachings of the time, and he believed that there were a whole set of teachings that would lead you astray, and he was specifically warning people about that. This was all adopted by the council as part of the core teachings. I mean, they were the Buddhist teachings to begin with, but they affirmed that this was an important part of the codification of the teachings of the Buddha. And then I think the other thing, and although this isn't codified in the suttas themselves, it's important in terms of several things you'll hear in just a moment about this historical development, is that the particular viewpoint was that the focus of everything would be on the teachings of the historical Buddha and not on any individual teacher. So that in the original community, and in at least to this day, in the true Theravadan communities, teachers are not considered to be like creating new and novel teachings. They are commenting on and reporting the teachings of the historical Buddha. So why I'm mentioning this will become important in just a moment. So the term Theravadin, or Theravada, where it comes from is it means the view of the elders. The view of the elders was established at that council. The view was is that these are the fundamental teachings of the historical Buddha, the fundamental psychology and the fundamental practices which we will adhere to. That's where Theravada, view of the elders, comes from. There were five, yeah?
How many years after the Buddha's death did this council?
3 months.
3 months, 90 days. 90 days. Yeah. And that sounds quick, and it was. And the reason, in part, that it was is they saw that, and I mentioned this last time, but it's clear that it was a motivator for this happening relatively quickly, was that when the leader of the Jains died, who was at the time kind of the other really dominant school in northern India, there was the historical Buddha and the Jains, the community very quickly dropped into dissension. There were all of these struggles for leadership of the group, and they could not agree on what, in fact, the core teachings were. So some of the rules in the Vinaya are based on that, and then this was, we're not going to allow that to happen. We're going to pull together all of the elders, we're going to define who the elders are, and we're going to lock this thing down for the good of the teachings and the good of the community. So there were five subsequent councils. And the next one was, let's see, the second council was 100 years after the first, so about 100 years after the Buddha died. They had 700 monks at this one. And the purpose was to revisit what was done at the first council. And this has happened on five subsequent separate occasions. And basically the question is, do we need to change anything? Is there some revision that is appropriate? So the second one was actually prompted over a proposal by a number of monks, kind of a series of sects within the community, requesting that there be changes, not in the teachings themselves, although there had started to be some kind of like disagreement over what the teachings meant, not the teachings themselves, but what they meant. But this was, there were 10 specific suggestions to change the Vinaya. And today they all seem like they're preposterously simple. But it shows you in those times they came out of a shramanic tradition, a wandering tradition, where the rule was is that you had nothing. You were completely, totally dependent for your clothing, your food, everything from the community around you. So like one of the proposals was is that monks would be able to keep salt in a container for use when it was needed, and to take the midday meal until the sun was in a certain position, not just 12 o'clock, but in a certain angle. Both of these ended up being like very controversial things and rejected by the council. Okay. So the council went back, rejected the 10 proposals, went back, reaffirmed all the teachings and took months once again to chant all the teachings again. And that has become a feature of every single council that's been held. Okay. Well, the reaction to this decision was not favorable. And several hundred monks broke off from the Theravadin community at the time. And they broke off not just on the rules of the Vinaya, but kind of the schism over this, like, broke open the kind of developing controversy over what some of the teachings actually meant. So at this point, these groups, a number of different sects formed, and we believe that at a certain point there were 21 different Theravadin schools. Now, they were all coming off the same teachings, but there were slight variations in how they would interpret certain of these. So this group that broke off, one of them, I'm just going to list off several of the major things, because they eventually developed into the first schools of Mahayana Buddhism. Okay, they morphed. So the most significant disagreements or changes in perspective were that they began developing a transcendentalist perspective regarding the Buddha. In other words, the Buddha was very clear that he was just a human being. You know, that he had no transcendental qualities. And so they started developing the idea that the Buddha was something more than just a human being, that there was some mystical, transcendental quality of the historical Buddha. They adopted Sanskrit as the language rather than Pali of the canons. They elevated the idea of the bodhisattva, which under Theravadin Buddhism there was one bodhisattva, into a more universal principle of multiple bodhisattvas. And these, among others, eventually served as some of the foundational principles that led to the next great school of Buddhism, which is the Mahayana school. And then the Mahayana school has all kinds of different schools within that large movement. The third council was under Emperor Ashoka, who you've heard of. You know, Ashoka was this extraordinary figure where he is reported to have been like this very ruthless expansionist leader. And there was this seminal event where a major battle, where he went onto the battlefield and saw the havoc that, you know, his intention and his orders had created, the thousands of people that had been killed. He subsequently met the Buddha, converted to Buddhism, converted India to a Buddhist country, and there was this reign of, basically, I don't know if it was enlightened, but moving towards enlightened government. So, under Ashoka, there was another council, and the purpose of this council was a little bit different. Okay, the second council, which was 100 years after the Buddha died, was over a dispute of whether or not the Vinaya, the ethical rule, should be expanded. There wasn't any dispute about the teachings. This third council was all about the teachings. By this time, there had been a real proliferation of the teachings and the sects that had broken off. There was lots of controversy. There were members within the primary Theravadin community that were advocating these new positions. A lot of dissension within the community. And so the purpose of this was actually to look at the teachings themselves, not the Vinaya, to the teachings. And it's one of its express purposes was whatever they decided, whoever didn't agree with it, to be basically kicked out of the community. It was like, you know, we're going to identify or reaffirm the fundamental teachings of the community. And if you're not on board with that, you have the complete right to go with another sect or form your own sect, but not be in this community. It was actually called purifying the community. And the it was sponsored by Ashoka himself. So they met, make a long story short, they didn't make any changes in the teachings. You know, the idea that the Buddha was something more than a man, changed the idea of what a bodhisattva was, you know, these kind of fundamental things. We're just, you know, we're not going to do it. They're contrary, actually, to the teachings that the Buddha himself enunciated. And they reaffirmed the teachings that were adopted at the First Council. And then a whole group of people left the community, integrated into other teachings. And at this point, after Ashoka, we basically know nothing at all about what happened to Buddhism in India. We think it just kind of disappeared for all practical purposes from India. We know it has now. You know, there's less than 5% of the population in India that is Buddhist. And all the focus shifted to Sri Lanka, which became, and really to this day, you know, is considered to be kind of the keeper of the historical teachings. So I want to jump from the third up to the sixth. And we're starting to get closer to Sacramento, by the way.
Okay. I have a question. When was it first, in one of these councils, when was it first written down? Was it anything written down by the third council?
You know, I don't know. Yeah, that's a good question. I should know the answer to that, and I don't. I don't know if we know with Ashoka, we know all those pillars and there's writing.
Yep.
So I think by that time it had been written down, but I'm not sure.
I was particularly interested when the Pali Canon was kind of. I know it diverged as it traveled around Asia, but you know, when was that kind of like, okay, that's.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. Sorry. So the Sixth Council was actually fairly recently. It was in 1954. Okay. You know, everybody thinks it's all ancient history, right? Like, wow, 1954, you know. So it took 2 years, in 1954 and 1956. It was in Myanmar, Burma, at that time. And the way that these would work, or at least, you know, the modern version of them, is there would be, they would have several key people who were recognized as like the world scholars on this. And then they would have what was called the chief resource person. The chief resource person's job was in front of the entire convocation to question the experts. So there is this format. So the chief resource person was a man named Mahasi Sayadaw. And Mahasi Sayadaw is kind of credited with reviving a lot of the old themes and emphases of practice. So, for example, by 1954, in Theravadan Buddhism, the role of meditation as the primary anchor of everything had started to dissipate. And so Mahasi Sayadaw brought that back, not only in a monastic role, but in the larger general lay community. So he was a real advocate of meditation in the lay community as a general practice. He kind of re-emphasized the idea that you could, there's been this debate about how much concentration you need to become awakened. Okay, and kind of like one theory is that you have to work through all of these graduated states of concentration called jhanic states And then there's another viewpoint that believes that you can develop concentration to what's called, quote, access concentration. It's a much lower level of concentration, and then use that as a platform to open to vipassana or insight, exploratory meditation. So Mahasi Sayadaw brought back and began emphasizing the idea of access concentration as the door into vipassana. So, and in fact, Steve Armstrong and Kamala Masters and a third person in the last several years have translated one of Mahasi Sayadaw's texts into English. It's a very big deal, you know. And when you read it, it's really exciting because Mahasi Sayadaw, you know, was 50, 60 years ago, he was bringing this back, and it's as relevant today as it was back then. I mean, it is the basis for so much of, particularly the insight Vipassana community, the way that we're carrying the teachings. So one of the students, and so to make a long story short, 2 years, they reaffirm all the teachings. Okay, not surprisingly, you know, but they reaffirm all the teachings, and then they take a year of chanting, doing the affirmation on the teachings. Amazing, you know. So Mahasi Sayadaw was like this kind of towering figure in the most recent council. One of Mahasi Sayadaw's key students was an Indian man who subsequently became a very famous teacher, called Munindra. And Munindra was Joseph Goldstein's first and most influential teacher.
And we're really close to second.
Well, it's going to get closer. So when Joseph went to Asia, you know, he went to Thailand. And he was in the Peace Corps, and he was teaching at a government school in the Peace Corps. And so kind of was dabbling in Thai Buddhism, came back, and then went to India looking for a teacher, and ended up in Bodh Gaya and met Munindra, and then was with Munindra off and on for 10 or 15 years. And, it was seminal in terms of Goldstein's grounding in the Dharma and his approach and his understanding. You read Munindra's work and read Joseph's, you can see the thread. Another student of Mahasi Sayadaw was a Burmese Myanmar teacher, now very, very old, whose name is Upandita. And he's like a towering figure. Subsequently, you know, he's grown into this towering figure. There's big centers, almost, you know, for us, kind of hilariously named Upandita Rama. So I'm not sure what that, you know, what the Rama means in Burmese. It's got to mean something reverential, but, you know, it's to us, it's kind of crazy. But Upandita is this, like, fierce, powerful teacher, and the next really influential teacher in Joseph Goldstein's practice was Upandita. Joseph went to Burma and studied with him. Stephen Armstrong, who has been one of the people overlooking this community before it was a community, he was one of three teachers, he, Kamala Masters, and John Travis, who were my supervisors, mentors during my training at Spirit Rock. So Stephen Armstrong for 5 years was a monk with Upandita. Kamala Masters was a nun with Upandita. So the link to Sacramento is, in this particular tradition, you can't do anything without getting approval. You know, it's, you just don't to go and say, well, you know, we're going to start Sacramento Insight Meditation. It just doesn't happen that way. So working with Joseph and Steve and Kamala, I went through the training program at Spirit Rock, and with the cooperation of James Perez, who was the head of the training program at that time, the five of us agreed that the purpose of my going through that program was to try to act as a catalyst to form a Theravadan-based community in Sacramento, and that the linkage would be the linkage I just described. So I went through the program and then started doing beginning meditation classes, and then at some point that started to take hold, and a group of people started to form around that who were still in the community, and together we formed Sacramento Insight Meditation 13 and a half years ago. You know, and here we are today. So, and then as part of that, they authorized me and also supervised a training program that we created for our mentors here. Which, so we've got, you know, Diane Wild, Rich Howard, Jeff Harden, who's now left, all who graduated and were mentors and presenters. Sandra Segrist, who does one-day retreats and has been on the board, and Dave Sanders, who's part of the chaplaincy program, all graduated from that program, and then started offering one-on-one guidance and counseling to members as part of that. So the idea behind that was to show, just as the historical community we talked about last time, that where did the teachers come from in the historical community? You know, they didn't come from the Bay Area. You know, they didn't come from the big city. Where they came from is within the community. So the idea behind that mentoring program was to show that right within in the community, right within each of us, there is this deep wisdom. And if we develop it, you can actually see it develop. And so where the leaders and the mentors and the teachers ought to be coming from is from the community itself, and not depending on those outside of the community. That was the idea behind the mentoring program. So, Theravadan Buddhism, this organization, Spirit Rock. You know, what have we really got? Well, you know, I think it's pretty clear that what's happening here is the same thing that's happened in every place that Buddhism has gone, is that Buddhism has adapted to the culture, and to some degree it's morphed into a new form. And, you know, here, with the nature of this culture is so powerful, and, you know, now Buddhism and mindfulness has become, you know, a commercial entity. You know, everything is mindfulness now. So I think it's an open question of, you know, what we have going. We've got, to a very limited degree, we have some ethnic Theravadan communities, and we have some Western monasteries that are Theravadan based, that are clearly Theravadan and following the Theravadan model. Spirit Rock and IMS, Insight Meditation Society, I would say are Theravadan based, but even between those two, there's a significant difference. If you look at Insight Meditation Society, which is where I frankly feel more resonance, they are much more oriented towards a Theravadan base. You know, they have a whole scholastic program. They have a forest monastery there. Out here on the West Coast, the West Coast Spirit Rock actually resulted from a difference of opinion and emphasis on where some of the practitioners wanted to go. So if you look at a lot of the programs that are being offered at Spirit Rock, you won't see them being offered back at IMS. That's not a value judgment. It's an observation. But there are, I think, a couple of, a number, there's a bunch of them, but I'm just going to highlight several, a couple of themes that we're seeing in this Western model, which is non-monastic, that it's up for grabs whether it survives or not. You know, it's a real open question. You know, it's offering something really valuable, but to the degree that it actually takes hold, and as I was mentioning last time, if the communities can get big enough to actually fund the survival, you know, and fund the teachers, if that doesn't happen, but it doesn't matter how great it is, it's not going to survive. So here are some of the, what I think are some of the themes we're seeing. The first one is, you know, we are really seeing what Mahasi Sayadaw started, and that is moving meditation back in as the centerpiece of practice. You know, not scholastic study, not service, but meditation as the core, and study and service being absolutely critical, you know, to a rounded, balanced community and practice, but with the meditation being as the foundation. A second one, and I think this is really significant, is you're seeing big centers like Spirit Rock and IMS advocating and teaching practices that before this particular approach in the West were primarily reserved for intense monastic practice. I mean, some of these suttas that we're working with would not have been taught to the lay community. I mean, they are deep, profound things, and they weren't being offered to the lay community. And many of the practices themselves, the way we're trying to practice, where we're having, you know, residential retreats and encouraging people to practice regularly, do one-day retreats, and then do, you know, basically monastic-oriented residential retreats, although there's always been a tradition in Asia of people going into, in some countries, you know, all the men at one point in their life go in for some period of residential work and then come out, and then that's pretty much it. They don't go back. And then in some of the countries, people are kind of going in and out of monasteries. But this particular model, where we're trying to actually take monastic practices and teachings for the lay community, is something that we just haven't seen any place before. That's a new phenomenon. Another one, which is really unusual, is all across the United States and in Europe now too, we're relying heavily on lay teachers rather than ordained or monastic teachers. So the very fact that, like, I can be sitting here and doing this and be fully authorized to do it, and everybody in the Western community feels completely comfortable with it, and that someone with my level of training and experience could be authorized to train other people, just unheard of in the past. So this is an unusual thing, and so, you know, it raises all kinds of questions about, you know, quality control, and I'm serious, you know, because before there were, you know, formal lineage holders, and you had to be at a quite high level of practice before you could even offer the Dharma. Well, that's all changing, and you know, it feels like it's all reasoned, but once again, I'm just it's an experiment, you know. Let's see. Okay, the other thing that I think is really noteworthy, and it's more noteworthy with respect, I believe, to like Spirit Rock, you know, the two great big Vipassana Insight Theravadin-based communities in the United States in the model I'm talking about are Spirit Rock and IMS. You know, there's smaller regional centers, you know, in Washington, D.C., there's a huge center, there's Gil Fronsdale's, that whole amazing operation down there, but the two big motherships are these two entities. And particularly the West Coast version of this is highly identified with meditation and certain principles of psychotherapy being very, very closely related to each other. once again, this is something really new. And it's, in my opinion, a source of enormous confusion for practitioners, and I actually think for some teachers, of where is the line between the Dharma and the line between psychotherapy. You know, we just have tons and tons and tons of courses for therapists on mindfulness, and, you know, mindfulness is not Buddhism. And so there's, you know, mindfulness-based courses, which doesn't mean that it's based on Buddhist causation or Buddhist psychology. So, you know, there's this whole thing that's happening in our culture. And I'm not commenting on whether it's good or bad. I'm just saying it's happening, and for a lot of people it's confusing. And so what is actually Theravadin-based, which in my opinion means that we're sticking with the historical psychology advance to the Buddha, which is based in a very particular idea about a self or the nature of a self, which is radically different than Western psychology. You know, so. And then I think the other thing that we're seeing, and once again, you know, a little bit confusing, is just a general advocacy and use of the Buddhist teachings and a lot of the Buddhist practices more for general health enhancement, stress reduction, professional performance, all this whole area, separate and apart from the larger intentions of Buddhist practice. So, you know, it's a fascinating thing, and I mean, I think it's absolutely true that we're seeing the evolution of a new form of Buddhism, and we'll see, you know, we'll see if it lasts. I certainly hope it does. And in my own case, I know that the way over the last 5 years in particular, what I have come to is, you know, forgetting about all the terms, but I feel this is consistent with what I've been saying about, you know, what it means to be trying to be Theravadin-based, is the thing that I'm most interested in is trying to get as close as I can to what I think, what I believe historically, are the actual teachings of the historical Buddha. I have become less and less interested in what other teachers have to say. I mean, I listen to that, but in an earlier stage, you know, you're listening to everyone to try to get your bearings, and you reach this point in practice that takes a while, but you begin to have a confidence in your own practice and your ability to actually understand the teachings in a particular historical context that you believe for you is the wisest, most skillful approach. So now that's really what I'm interested in. You know, I'm really trying to get as close as I can to what I feel are the historical teachings and what the Buddha was trying to say by that. I do much more study of the suttas now than I did before. You know, I do spent much more time looking at some of the historical material about the development of this and the lives of not just the Buddha but the people around him. I find that really, really instructive and helpful. And so that's, so we go from the time of the Buddha to Sacramento to 8:55 tonight. So we actually do have a little bit of extra time to talk about this or questions or comments, because I think this is just rich and valuable material. I think it's awfully helpful for all of us to look at the historical development of this school, of other schools, of how schools have arrived at what teachings they're relying on and why, and you know, making our own decisions about what is actually going to help us as practitioners and as human beings. You know, I mean, this is the end game. You know, it's like what's going to really be helpful for us. So, was it you?
Yeah, I was just curious. I think people out there, they think of Buddhism, they think of the Dalai Lama. And you didn't say anything about the Dalai Lama. This history is connecting to the past up to Sacramento. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on how you felt the Dalai Lama kind of fit in.
Okay. Well, there's, you know, there's these different traditions. And the Dalai Lama is not in from the Theravadan tradition. So I think the Tibetan teachings are beautiful. There's many things about them that are unique and valuable. In our mission statement, we say that we try to utilize teachings from other traditions that resonate with the Theravadan. So, you know, we've got Tibetan tantras on the wall. You know, if you've ever listened to one of my talks, you know, probably every other talk, I'm quoting the Dalai Lama, you know. So, I don't know if the Dalai Lama is enlightened, but he must be pretty close. And just having him on this planet for me, and I think anybody who's serious about Buddhism feels that it's a gift. But in terms of like my training, I have no training in that school. So that kind of linkage, you know, my training and the lineage is very, I can really connect it quite clearly through what I described tonight, but there is no such connection with, like in the Mahayana tradition or the Vajrayana tradition, which is Tibetan.
Which is the Tibetan tradition?
Vajrayana.
When did that branch off?
Well, you know, you come along and the Mahayana school develops, and then the Mahayana school breaks into all these different forms. So there's, you know, there's Chinese, which has a very, very heavy Taoist influence, right? And there's Japanese, and then it travels all the way up to Tibet. You know, so like when we go on the pilgrimage, we go to Nalanda, which is, you know, this great university, which is basically Mahayana Buddhism. Yeah. So, you know, it's thousands of years of development of all of these different schools. You know, I mean, it's an extraordinary thing how it's moved into different areas. And each area, when it went into Tibet, you know, there was the Bon religion that was already there, the indigenous, and so it took on some of the elements of that in the same way that it's happening here.
Are the you know, like dependent origination.
Yeah, and here, just let me just say one thing. For those who are here who are interested in like more about Tibetan Buddhism, Gus Kaler, who's in the back, my longtime practice buddy, is a longtime and knowledgeable Tibetan practitioner. And I'm volunteering Gus, but I think even if I asked, he would agree. He'd love to talk with you because he loves practice and he loves Tibetan Buddhism, and he's a scholar too of it. So, yeah, for sure. So I'm sorry.
Well, things we work with, impermanence and dependent origination and the precepts, are these functionally different than some of these other lineages?
Okay, so this is an interesting question. Yeah, this is an interesting question. I think I think that this is a true answer that needs to be modified. Okay, all right, is that in every school of Buddhism, you know, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, are the foundation. Okay, having said that, you know, there are traditions that almost never even refer to the Buddha. You know, there's schools of Buddhism, but they're referring to lineage holders and their interpretation of the original teachings. So it's really easy to buy the books, for example, of some very prominent people in some of the traditions, and there's almost no reference to the Buddha at all. You know, And then within all of the schools, there's sects within the schools. So there are some sects that don't refer to the Eightfold Path. They even call it something different based on historically a prominent teacher languaging of that. Okay, there are amongst different teachers in this tradition, and certainly between the different traditions, emphasis on different things. You know, so where I think in the approach that we're taking, you know, we're really out front with dependent origination, and that there are other schools that aren't. That's not what they're leading with. They're leading with other things. So I think the way to think about it is that there actually is this core, and then there's this whole thing that we call the Pali Canon, and how the different schools use that is different based upon historical development, what they combined with, you know, Taoism or some other local traditions, and then the inclination of the individual teacher.
But it would seem like the core, if it's Eightfold Path, but they call it something else, don't even refer to a path. it seems like the principles would be the same. I can't imagine how they would distort it in some way and arrive at the same place.
Yeah. Well, I'm actually thinking of one school in particular, and they don't care too much about the Eightfold Path. You know, I mean, and that's not a criticism. I'm just saying, you know, historically it's developed in a particular way that they're really leading and emphasizing a series of things. But like the prison group led by Diane Wild, they have people from every tradition, okay? And their baseline position is that regardless of what school we're from, we're teaching the fundamentals. We're teaching the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, ethical conduct, and everybody's welcome to put their individual spin on that or the spin of their tradition. But we're all Buddhists, and it means those for sure, right? Yeah, you know.
So, you know, you're kind of talking about this Western American experiment with Theravada Buddhism. But is there anything in America that can be like a correction mechanism for when this experiment goes awry? I mean, I think in Asia, there's a certain orthodoxy that maybe had held in monasteries or something.
Yeah.
Is there enough of a monastic tradition here that there can actually be some sort of, or we just kind of like this balloon that's broken off, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong or whatever, but it's floating. Is there enough of what it originated from actually here in this hemisphere for there to be any kind of connection? I get the sense that except maybe the ethnically based monasteries, they're kind of like established after this has already happened, so there can be real, people really want to be a monastic, can actually be a monastic here. So
yeah,
established. You know, is it clear what I'm asking? Is there any kind
of
like...
No, I get it completely.
Yeah.
And I think, I think that's just a completely open question.
Okay.
And, you know, we've got, John goes up to Abayagiri,
right.
You know, which is from an English tradition. You know.
Right.
And so we've got Abayagiri in the Mahayana tradition. You know, we have a monastic community down in Southern California. But the ones that are monastic and primarily Western students, there's just not a lot of them. You know, it just hasn't happened yet. So, you know, I think that there's conscious efforts to try to build in a container. You know, and you see that, in my opinion, in the structure that's at IMS. You know, But I don't think anybody knows. I mean, we really, really are, in my opinion, just at the infancy. You know, if you think, like even the San Francisco Zen Center and Suzuki Roshi and all of that, how old is that? I mean, that's not even 70 years old. 70 years old is nothing in terms of somehow putting roots into a new culture of a tradition like this, particularly when it's morphing, you know. So, the Buddha said that we're swimming upstream. You know, this is never going to be the mainstream. Maybe mindfulness, whatever mindfulness is now, will be real minds, a mainstream. But the idea that what we understand to be true Buddhist practice will become mainstream is just hard to believe, and the Buddha said that that's just not going to happen. It's, and any of us who have practiced for a while and really done this, this is really tough stuff. It is not for the faint of heart, and most people don't want to face things the way this practice demands that you face them. So it's always going to be a minority position, and I think we will always have monastic communities. I think, you know, that will survive. The question is, what's going to survive of this thing that we're creating, which is the derivative of the monastic communities? I think that's the big question. And just to relate a quick story here, and then I'll end. During my training, there were some things happening. I was much more conservative in my outlook about all of this. You know, now I have a relaxed attitude about it because I realize there's nothing you can do about it. It's happening, you know. And to be getting upset about it is just another form of suffering, right? So it's like, okay, it's happening, and, you know, all I can do is take care of my little piece, you know, and try to do that, right? That's all I can do, right? You know, and try to help the people around me. But that wasn't my attitude during my training, and some stuff was happening in this training program that I thought was just kind of crazy. And so I met with Steve Armstrong, and I was really upset about it, you know. And so, as usual, you know, he's always this big, spacious mind, and he's just listening to me, you know. And so I very passionately laid out this criticism and was very upset about it and everything. And, you know, then I stopped. And so he just sat there for a second, and he said, "Well, you think you're done?" You know, he's like, "Have you gotten it all out?" You know, and I said, "Yeah, I think so." And he goes, "Well," he said, "listen, here's the deal." He said, nobody's going to hurt the true Dharma. You know, all this stuff you're worried about, and you think this, well, nobody's going to make the real Dharma disappear." And he said, "We'll know in 20 or 25 years if the things that you're objecting to in this new form are actually true Dharma or not. And we just have to be patient and see." Like, okay. But I mean, you know, it's that kind of spaciousness that's required, is that this is an experiment, and, you know, we have to give people the benefit of the doubt. And in this community, we're all acting and or trying to act in good faith. And what nobody knows what this is going to look like in even 20 years from now. So it's an open question. So holding, for me, having a solid understanding of what at least the history of this particular tradition looks like is what allows me to relax into everything else, because I feel confident of what my bearings are. So I'll hear stuff, and that may be great for somebody else. I'm just not going to go there, but I'm not ready to say that that's inappropriate. You know, if it's really helping somebody and it's actually pointing them in a dharmic direction, you know, then we'll see what happens. So, okay, one more.
I thank you for the historical perspective. And I think I hear what you're trying to preserve and your concerns. But I also think that with the mindfulness, and yes, it's been very commercialized, et cetera, that language is so powerful, and it has been such a gift, I think, to this culture, that it's come in, this notion. And I think most people who have heard of that concept know it has something to do with kindness and not being your jerk self, that there are other feelings and things to consider. And the other thing that I really love about it is that it's gender neutral, that men are expected to be mindful too, because a lot of those qualities have been assigned in our culture to women before. So I think it's been an incredible gift of Buddhism to this culture. So I want to celebrate that too.
Yeah. So if... I wasn't making a judgment about it. I was trying to objectively observe that it's become commercial, and what it is and isn't is up for grabs. And so just as an illustration, historically, there is mindfulness, and then there are other qualities of mind that are brought in as a configuration of practice. But you know, if you look strictly at a historical definition of mindfulness, it does not include kindness or compassion. That those are separate states of mind that are configured in with mindfulness. So the way we're presenting it is, well, mindfulness is kind, and it's this and it's that. Well, in kind of, you know, but
a nice integration,
you know. I mean, it's just getting all jumbled up. And I'm not saying that that might not be terribly helpful. I think it is in many ways. But it's just to distinguish. I think it's helpful for people to know what something is and what it isn't. And I have so many people come in, like, for practice interviews and start explaining, talking about mindfulness and what they're doing, and they're lost. You know, they have no idea what they're talking about. And it's like, okay, well, let's go back to basics, you know. So I'm talking from a Buddhist perspective, right? And then there's, you know, this is a discussion that, seriously, we could have for many, many nights, you know, to explore all of this. It's exciting. And for some people, really troubling, too. So, okay. So I think that's it for tonight, and I'd like to thank you all very much for coming. I hope this has been helpful, and in a world with so much suffering, may our good intentions and our efforts to really practice really benefit not just ourselves and everyone we know, but in some real way, everybody who's suffering in the world. So thank you. Mm-hmm.